Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
And I'm Tosin Unifawakin.
Dwayne DeFreitas should be joining us a little bit later. He's running a little late. But in the meantime, this week, Twitter stock launches, Snapchat turns down Facebook, a new 3D printer using sound and lasers, Russians bring malware into space, Netflix makes a super deal with Marvel, and it turns out this is the end for DVD rentals. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com. You can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And this week, I received another one of my Kickstarter project rewards. And the Kickstarter project that I funded this time was the GameStick, which is the other Android-based portable game console other than the Ouya. The Ouya was the first one which I had funded, and I received that reward. And I received last week the GameStick, which they sent me a full version of the GameStick. Plus, I ordered an extra controller for extra fun with somebody else. And so I fired it up. It's a small. It's basically a little bit a little bit bigger than like a Super Nintendo controller, maybe 1.5 times the size of a Super Nintendo controller, and roughly about the same sort of flat dimensions with rounded edges as a Super Nintendo controller. And within the controller itself is a USB, I'm sorry, not a USB stick, it's an HDMI stick. That is powered by USB. So it's USB-powered HDMI stick, and that plugs directly into the back of the TV, and that is the entire game system right there in that little stick, and it communicates via Bluetooth with the controller. I see we have Dwayne on. How you doing, Dwayne?
I'm all right. How you guys doing?
Good. We're talking about the GameStick, which I received as a Kickstarter reward last week. So plugged it in, and I have to say, I had some issues with this GameStick. It wasn't, I'm not sure that I can completely recommend it at this point. First of all, the Wi-Fi connectivity was a little weak. I had to get a Wi-Fi repeater and plug it in like virtually right next to the device in order for it to find the signal and download the update in order to play the system for the first time.
How many feet away from your actual router was it?
I had to plug it the repeater in about 6 feet away from the GameStick in order for it to
I know, but how far is that from where your router normally is? Like where your wireless
the router
signal?
Is in like two rooms away.
Okay.
But it was still getting a good, 75% signal. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't strong enough to effectively download the update, the firmware update. So after trying that out, the other problem that I had with the GameStick, let me say, first of all, before I get into some of the negatives, the positives are the menu system is easy to use. The games themselves play well. The graphics look nice and sharp for an Android-based low-power console.
Basically, do you feel like it's better than the Ouya?
Is it fun?
Well, even before it's fun, are the graphics better than the Ouya graphics?
The graphics, I would say, are on par with the Ouya. However, the one major thing that puts the Ouya ahead, and it dings the game stick a bit, is that there's a tremendous amount of lag between the game controller and the game stick itself. Like, reaction time is like half a second, which is unacceptable for any sort of video game.
Reaction time is a factor in this, so please pay attention.
Now, do you think that's something they can resolve via software?
That is a very good question. I thought about that myself. I don't know, because I think it might be a Bluetooth issue. And I was like standing very close to the game stick with the controller, and it was still laggy. So I'm hoping that it's something that other people are taking note of and commenting on, and maybe it's something they can fix with a firmware update. If I don't see any forum posts about it, I'm going to post something myself, complain to them about it, because otherwise it's just not ready for prime time. And between the comparison with the Ouya, is the Ouya beats it out as far as that goes.
I'm surprised that it got funded in after a time where, you know, people had basically chosen whether they were down with Android consoles or not based on the Ouya, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's got a lot of potential. I got to hand it to him. And there is a lot of potential there. I just think there's just some non-starter issues that keep it from competing with the Ouya fairly.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if any of that has to do with the whole USB powered device thing. I find that my Chromecast, when I first hooked it up, it took a while for I was worried if it'd be underpowered getting power from my TV's USB port. It's just so small, but so it doesn't need a lot of power. But at the same time, is USB power enough to really get it what it needs in order for it to perform and draw those frame rates? It turns out the Chromecast is, but I could see something having to do, reactive input based work.
Yeah,
not being up to the task on that kind of power.
Yeah, which it's unacceptable if you're trying to play games, like split-second timing on games. You got to have, like, fast reaction, zero lag, or as little lag as possible.
Yeah.
Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
Well, I've been messing around with video streaming, and primarily I've been using an application called Universal Media Server. So it sounds like, From what I understand, Universal Media Server was kind of a split from PlayStation Media Server, kind of what they considered an evolution from it, because they found that PlayStation Media Server was not moving quickly enough and was also quite, unstable and had lots of other issues. So this is sort of a more slimmed down media server approach. And so a little background about the items that I've used, currently I have a server that has Plex on it. I also have, readily used PlayStation Media Server among other sort of streaming items. And specifically, Universal Media Server is really quick and easy to set up, and it's very clean UI. It's very sort of minimalistic in terms of what you need. I'm kind of delightfully pleased about it so far. One of the large factors and improvements that I've actually seen comes with subtitles, because one of the issues that I've had the most problem with in the past, and I haven't really tried to investigate much of it within Plex, but at least with PlayStation Media Server among other things, is files that don't necessarily have a separate subtitle file but have subtitles built into them. I've never been able to really get that to work properly.
And works fine on Apple TV.
Well, Apple TV is also probably somewhat limited in terms of file types, right?
You just re-encode your stuff to an M4V, and it has soft subs in it, and it works perfectly fine.
Right. So I'm not in the mood for doing any sort of re-encoding. And Universal Media Server actually has this concept of live subtitles where it can actually fetch the subtitles for you online.
Oh, wow.
Which is
Doesn't
really
Plex
cool.
Do that?
Plex, to my understanding, Plex does not. And they actually have this really nice comparison chart. Now, granted, this comparison chart is coming directly from Universal Media Server's site, so take it with what you will. But I was actually watching the documentation on Pirate Bay, and that was actually where I needed subtitles because they're all from Europe, and so I needed to be able to understand it, and it worked flawlessly. I was really pleased, delighted. So,
wow,
worth checking out.
I think you told me about this a couple weeks ago, and at that time I loaded it into my system, and I've been using it on my PS3 to stream media from my Drobo as well, and it seemed to work pretty well. Yeah, I can't really notice a difference between comparing that to the PlayStation Media Server. But it works just as well as the PlayStation Media Server in any case.
You know, if you have a Windows machine and you drop a video into the videos folder, it automatically shows up on your PlayStation for you to play any video. So, like, basically, whenever I take some video or whatever, and it goes off my camera and it gets imported into the videos folder, there's like a DLNA server or UPnP server running on Windows machines out of that folder. That folder is what we'll call hot. So turn on your PlayStation and it's playing right there. So until the advent of this iMovie share feature on the Apple TV, we'd light up after a day of snowboarding or whatever, light up the PlayStation 3 with the stuff sitting on any footage you've taken sitting on in that folder. And it shows up, your computer name shows up with a little Windows icon. You hit that, and you've got all the videos right there to play. So it also works on Xbox.
Oh, nice.
So if you guys are not opposed to cracking open Windows, this is Windows 7, latest version. Yeah, well, I mean, say what you will, but that's an out-of-the-box experience.
Yeah,
that works
with
any H.264 encoded video, which is what my iPhone and GoPro and the Contour devices all record. So, out of the box, turn it on, put it in a folder, you're playing.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Assuming you want to go with their default locations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing about things nowadays is there's kind of a plethora of options. So in the past, there wasn't very much. You had to do a lot of customization, and now everything's much more simplistic. So, yay for the future.
Yay. Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
Not last week, but I guess early November. I picked up the current iPhone 5S just because it was time to do that yearly upgrade that I do. Basically, having had an iPhone 5 and iPhone 4S, I would say that if you're a person who has the iPhone 5, unless you require Touch ID, at this time, there's no discernible difference between the feeling of the way the reaction time and the speed of the device. The only thing that I could say is noticeably different from just a regular use. Used it every day, not just taking it around the block for review and passing it on. Uh-huh. But after a deep 2 week use of the device, I'd say the only thing that's materially different is the camera. The camera is absolutely phenomenal.
Really?
Yeah. I take a photo, and the photo is taken before I really. The first couple times I took one, I didn't even know I had taken it because the shutter is that fast. You don't need that animation of the shutter closing or anything like that. It simply snaps and it's there.
Are you responding to the quality of the photos themselves or the experience of taking?
I'm going to say both. The experience of taking photos in iOS 7 was something that I thought was diminished, actually, from the number one, because moving back and forth between video and Square and all sort of stuff, it didn't have the same easy, tactile, intuitive interface, right? You have kind of have to slide the whole area and hope that it goes to where you want it to go, as opposed to just sliding from camera to video. Uh-huh. But with the iPhone 5S, I feel like it's a smoother transition between, or maybe I just learned it, but just in terms of taking video or taking a shot on your phone, the shutter speed is noticeably quicker. The quality of the shots is better. You look at the shots and in low light, that's where you see the big difference. In normal daylight, there's nothing to write home about in terms of difference. They're both great shots.
Sure.
But in low light, it's a much different beast. And it's a different beast when it comes to movement. I take a lot of shots of kittens because kittens in my house, right? And part of being a geek is knowing that at any time I can create a new meme with my kittens. And they do it very fast. Now, the slow motion setting is really interesting. I don't necessarily know how to wield that properly, so I won't talk too much on it. But it's there. You take your photos, you take your video, you play it back, and it's a super easy way to play it back in slow motion. If you change the sort of the linear tuner, let's call it, at the top of the phone or whatever, uh-huh. You're getting that slow motion. You can tell where it's going to speed up and slow down. It's really the sort of thing where you take the video, you take another video, and you're going to be putting some stuff together on via iMovie or Final Cut Pro or something like that. So that's kind of how I've been able to use that feature. It's an interesting feature. I have yet to truly explore it. But other than that, the 5S Touch ID is interesting. I find I have an old habit of continuing to enter the code and not using Touch ID. I also have a case on my phone, which was a case designed for the iPhone 5. Newer iPhone 5S cases uh-huh. don't have anything surrounding the circle and the hole, uh-huh. the circle and the sensor like mine does. It's the first iPhone I've ever seen that doesn't have a square icon on the button because the Touch ID circle has replaced that. So it's pretty interesting just in terms of like recognition of the device, uh-huh. Looking at it, feeling it, and feeling that there is no like straight up home. I think it's a solid device. It feels good in the hand, just like the iPhone 5 did. It's definitely an incremental boost, but what I have found is that the LTE coverage in my iPhone 5, and I got the device replaced once. I'd be sitting there with my girlfriend's iPhone 4S and my iPhone 5, and she'd have 4G or she'd have 4G. And I'd be hanging out on Edge, even though it's an LTE-capable phone. That happened more than once. And in India, when we were visiting India, I'd be on, like, GPRS, and she'd be on 3G, and I've got the iPhone 5. And, you know, if I'm at home, I'd just, you know, I'd be on Edge, and, you know, she'd be blown away at 4G if we weren't on Wi-Fi. This has not happened on the 5S. So I'm not – I know that they extended the Wi-Fi bandwidth, you know, the antenna to talk to more bands. I don't think with AT&T that was really an issue with the 5 because it was designed for AT&T's network. That said, whatever they've done has made it so that that problem is completely gone.
Oh, great!
So if you've got a four style phone like a 4S, uh-huh, uh-huh. then you know upgrading to the 5 is going to be great. 5S is going to be great because you're going to get that real estate, and the real estate is the first thing my girlfriend noticed when she got my legacy iPhone 5. That's a huge thing. But if you've got an iPhone 5 already, rushing to get the 5S, I don't know that that's necessary.
Yeah,
I feel like getting the 5 from the 4S, unless you wanted the screen size, wasn't a big deal. It didn't feel, especially in the beginning when iOS 6 was new, the 4S did not feel slow at all. The same thing is true for the 5. So from the 4S to the 5, there wasn't a big difference. From the 5 to the 5S, there doesn't feel like a huge difference either. But I will say that I would imagine as time goes on and applications begin to roll out in a 64-bit mode, we might find that some games are going to run faster. The one app that does run somewhat faster is Infinity Blade. It loads in absolutely no time, which is interesting. Because on the 5, it's a pretty solid game. But you throw Infinity Blade 2, that's the one I was using, on this thing, and it loads as if it's a web browser. It just loads that quickly.
Wow.
So if you're thinking about playing handheld games, that is a way to go. There are coming there's a company coming out with an analog joystick controller for the iPhone. They've already created one for Android. This is where that begins to shine. It's basically you dock your iPhone or your Android phone on top of the controller, and you're using a handheld controller. Kind of turns it into a PS Vita type thing. Mm-hmm. And I think games are really where it's going to shine. It's interesting to see what they've been doing with this A7 chip, and I'm interested in seeing like where it goes. But as the device goes, you know, it's an iPhone, and it works really well. It's not a phenomenal jump from the last one, but I have a feeling that when iOS 8 comes out, it's really going to be one of those things where you either have a 5S or you're getting a new phone.
Yeah, I have a 5 right now, so like you mentioned, I'm not rushing out to get the 5S. I may wait to get the 6 or the 6S, depending on how long I can hold on to the 5 without feeling I need to upgrade. All right, let's get into some of the headlines here. Now, last week on the show with Greg Davies, we talked about the end of DVD rentals as all Blockbuster stores were being shut down by Dish Network, the company that owns Blockbuster.
Some stores are still holding out in that they're trying to see if they can retain the Blockbuster branding and basically be independent video stores.
Yes, some stores are licensed. There are about 50 licensed Blockbuster stores. They're not owned by Dish. They're licensed. The Blockbuster name is licensed by Dish. But as far as official Blockbuster stores go, we kind of joked on the show that this was the end of DVD rentals, and as it turns out, the very last video that was rented from an official Dish Network owned Blockbuster store at 11 p.m. on November 9th in Hawaii was the movie "This Is the End." Appropriately enough,
see, Dish gets it. Dish gets that. That is an appropriate tidbit.
Yeah, yeah.
To make public. Not many store brands that are shutting down legacy platforms. Let's call Blockbuster what it is. It was a platform for getting the promotion and distribution of film. It's a detail that Dish, which is probably the most geek friendly service provider out there in terms of cable and other services, drop. Like that's a "This Is the End" is it's very appropriate. It's something that's going to go in the annals of time because the video store, like the record store, was a cultural hub.
Absolutely. It changed entertainment in America for a period of time. So yeah, Dish took a picture of the momentous occasion and put it on the web, and Seth Rogen, who is one of the stars of the film, also tweeted the moment as well. So kind of a tender, bittersweet ending to DVD rentals.
Yeah, and potentially video game rentals in store. I remember some of those days.
Can't you still go to GameStop and rent videos, games?
I don't think, can you rent?
I don't know if you can rent. You can purchase. You can definitely purchase from, you can purchase used and you can return used, but I don't think you can rent.
I have to say that I don't think I've ever rented a video game.
I remember back in the day when, you know, because this is the time where most of the socialization was not online, but as kids, we would go over to friends' house and play games. And so every once in a while, we'd rent a game so we could go, you know, have a long weekend and play that game together. So
and now I'll never
I remember
be able
to. In the year, like, I think it was 2003 or 2002, I coughed up a whole $30 to Blockbuster in order to have a month of unlimited videos. It was a coup. the idea that I could give them $30. I was right out of college, and I had some, you know, I was doing like a big internship, but I had some time, some days during the week, and I would spend that $30 for, I did it for like 3 or 4 months, and I would get these movies. Blockbuster was about 8 or 9 blocks away from my house, and I was still living at home at the time, at 23. I just got back from college again, and I'd watch, you know, whatever movie I had, or TV show or whatever it was, and I'd walk all the way back there and swap it out, and I'd really get my money's worth. I like was thinking about it in terms of what's my cost per movie, and I would get that down. I think I got it down to like, I know my eyes were bloodshot from watching so much shit. It was all like kind of melding together in my head. But I think I got it down to like less than a dollar for sure per month. It was
That
like
that's how I felt the first time that I got the Netflix subscription. I'm like, how many movies can I rent within a month to make it worth it so that I'm maximizing my subscription, you know, like they're paying me to watch movies.
But in Netflix, that gets you flagged. In Netflix, they definitely for a long time they would identify people who are frequent use people, and they would slow down their rate of return.
You're right. They would. I noticed that after a while. Okay, moving on here. So 6 weeks after planning to fix the world's worst comments, YouTube last week released its new Google Plus commenting system. Starting this week, comments will be sorted by relevance instead of how recent the comment was. And from now on, commenting on YouTube will require a connecting a Google Plus account. Jawed Karim, one of YouTube's original creators, took to the comments for the first time in 8 years and asked, "Why the fuck do I need a Google Plus account to comment on a video?" Karim seems to be voicing confusion that other online users have felt. A YouTube product forum had been bombarded with backlash from users wanting Google Plus out of their YouTube comment threads. Scrolling through the last few days' worth of topics listed in the YouTube product forum shows most are complaints about the integration of Google Plus and YouTube. More than 900 topics were added in the last few days, probably prompted by a Reddit post pointing readers directly to the product forum link. Users online are outraged about the idea that you have to have a Google Plus account now to comment on YouTube. I don't know. What do you guys think? Because it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, the comments are no longer anonymous. They're associated with an account, which is most likely a name account by Google Plus's design. On the other hand, no more anonymous comments.
Yeah, so you know what's actually really interesting about this move? Very recently, so I'm a sports guy, and recently ESPN actually made a similar move where they changed their commenting system from being able to generate an account to now linking to your Facebook account. So to comment, you actually have to use your Facebook account to do so. And there was, as with Google now, there was huge outrage about it from, you know, the sports fanatics and the people who like to have anonymity. And now that it's been this way, probably for maybe it's a bit a month. I'm not exactly. I can't recall exactly when the change went in. It's, you know, the people have kind of moved on and learned to accept it for what it is, and
Here's
are,
the
you know,
bottom line.
it hasn't stopped anything. It hasn't made a huge difference in terms of how users are interacting with the software. Potentially, it's cleaned it up a little bit from what I've seen, a little bit, but people still do say stuff with their normal accounts too, so.
So here's the thing. Who didn't see this coming? Right? Like, YouTube is owned by Google. About 3 years ago, you had to link your YouTube account to a Google account. This is like the great evil. Google Plus is like the great evil in The Fifth Element. It's just coming. It's coming to everything, and it's coming to everywhere. Now, is it evil? Absolutely not. Google Plus is the best thing Google could do. By associating and assimilating all of their various services into one cohesive unit, Google's basically laying out that you have a Google ID, not only like an Apple ID, and that Google ID is going to get you access to all this cool shit, and it's all free. what ESPN did with Facebook, another brilliant move, because in order to pull that off, you've got to give ESPN some permissions. Those permissions are going to allow ESPN to pull in all of your social graph data, or as much of it as they can justify, and suddenly you're profiled, and they understand who you are, who's acting, who, you know, who's taking what actions on their services in terms of the data you've given to Facebook, and that makes them a more powerful advertiser. So both of these guys are trying to get more out of comments, and if they're able to get more meaningful comments out of it because anonymity is gone, that's a good thing for everybody, really. If someone's just saying stuff to troll and get our reactions, you know, that might spark some talking and everything. But in the end, meaningful comments tied to a user's interest and able to grab data around that means that they can enlighten the user with the types of, you know,
with better ads.
I would say that they can enlighten the user with better offers. They don't necessarily need to rely on the old school ad focus so much. The more you know about a user, the less you need to interrupt them with ads. And interruptive advertising is what people dislike. All the data shows that people don't mind being enlightened about things that they're interested in anyway. They're like, oh, there you go. Relevance is everything, and that's where the internet has to move in order to grow. So I don't think this is the thing. The only thing that bothers me is that with YouTube, the relevance thing, that's an algorithm that, you know, people aren't necessarily going to agree with. It'd be nice to be able to sort by most recent to see what's trending.
Right, to be able to change that. I think I agree with you that it's definitely something we all saw coming, especially given that, you know, Google and all the areas are trying to really make that unified platform and a unified place to go, as well as, you know, as you've been saying for years, big data, right? So I just think, understandably so, I could see how a lot of people just don't really want to buy into the full Google architecture, right? They don't necessarily want to have a Google Plus account because, you know, they don't really use it for much.
Right.
So I could see where that backlash is coming from. I just feel like people are going to, unfortunately, or fortunately for Google, it's eventually going to die down, and, you know, people will accept it for what it is.
I mean, and it's also like people don't like change. Yeah. It's the only constant thing in the universe is change, and people don't like it. They like doing what they were doing before. They don't want to learn a new thing. It's one of the reasons why I still use an iPhone, because I don't want to have to learn a new operating system when it comes to the intimacy that I have with my phone device on Android. Does that mean that it's better? No. Does that mean that it's worse, rather? No. I think Google is looking forward and like, yeah, there's going to be some upsetness, some consternation, some of this, some of that. But as we grow in users, the new users will understand, and people who want to comment will comment. And we'll have more meaning in those comments because they're tied to whoever these people are. And these comments are going to show up on their Google Plus profile and into the feeds and over to the circles. So over time, there's going to be more awareness about whatever bit of content this is because it's kind of stretching out into the Googledom. And that's a good thing.
All right. Speaking of monumental changes amongst tech companies, Microsoft is killing off its controversial stack ranking system this week. While this could be viewed as an internal change that won't affect consumers directly, it will have a broad effect on current and future Microsoft employees that may just shape the future of the company. Stack ranking is a process where each business unit's management team has to review employee performance and rank a certain percentage of them as the top performers or as average or poorly performers. And in this, using this method, they tended to drop employees who were the worst performers of the group. Former Microsoft employees have claimed it leads to colleagues competing with each other, especially when some employees in a group need to be given poor reviews to match the method. Vanity Fair's Kurt Eichenwald blamed a combination of Microsoft's obsessive focus on Windows and Office and the company's internal stack ranking system for, quote, a lost decade and cannibalistic culture. Eichenwald interviewed a number of current and former Microsoft employees who all cited stack ranking as the most destructive process inside the software giant.
I mean, this is a great thing. The news exposes a process inside of an extremely important company in America. Mm-hmm. Microsoft's an extremely important company, regardless of, you know, rumors of their death are greatly exaggerated, but they're extremely important. The news exposes it. It looks at it critically. It looks at it deeply. It shows its flaws. And within a couple years, or within, several months, a year, whatever, there's change there because the executives probably couldn't see the problem at their level.
Yeah.
Everyone's just an asset. We need to optimize our assets. But when you begin to use the human story to show that you're actually losing assets, perhaps in some cases, because you're realizing that you could have the best little, pod or team in the company, but someone has to lose, even if that engine is firing on all cylinders. That fact that someone has to lose gets away from the point of meritocracy. It says it doesn't right. matter how well you've done because you're not, we have to force your managerial layer to choose between you. And you end up with this awful Sophie's Choice situation where everyone's doing a great job. Everyone has slightly different roles. Everyone's an individual. And you're worried about diversity on your team in terms of diversity of thought, of course, because the odd man out isn't necessarily the person who's not delivering. It's just the person who, for whatever reason, has to be chosen to be the baddie.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get the proper compensation, the proper raise, the proper whatever. And that turns it off. So this is where the system works. This is where the media has done something positive in terms of moving things forward. And will the end user see this? The quality of product is likely to become better in the face of an optimization of stack ranking. They're going to have to replace it with something else. They're going to have to find a thing that's going to be as useful conceptually, but without the negative consequences on the back end, the negative externalities. So.
Yeah, no, Microsoft isn't the only company that does things similar to that.
Yahoo's been rumored to employ the stack ranking system as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know that IBM does something maybe not quite like it, but each employee gets a particular ranking, and there can only be a certain number of plus ones as well as others. Now, that does not necessarily mean that there has to be a negative, like a loser. There is, there isn't a maximum number of people who are performing at an adequate level.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as though there has to be someone at that negative level, but there is that sort of competitive nature where depending on how you are doing performing versus your colleague, you could potentially get a higher ranking.
I mean, 360 reviews are a pretty positive way that companies are working to get the most out of everybody. You not only have to perform well, but you have to perform well in a way that your other companies respect, and it's less about being the hotshot who's force of personality and more like working collaboratively in teams. So, I mean, there are many ways to get around this. I'm not going to say stack ranking was the worst thing in the world. I think it showed up because necessity is the mother of invention. And when you have a gigantic company like that, need to make sure that everybody's, no one's leaning back on their ass. No one's becoming complacent in the way that we saw Yahoo suffering from when it came to their employees earlier this year. That was exposed. Stack ranking is going to make it so that if you're sitting at home all day long, quote unquote, telecommuting, when in fact you're taking care of the baby or whatever, then you're not going to come across as productive as your peer, and because of that, stack ranking is going to get you. And that's in that it solves that problem. It just has these negative externalities that needs to get worked on.
All right, and Twitter this week held its initial public offering on the New York Stock Exchange. Opening its stock up for purchase to any interested investor, and as it turns out, there were a lot of them. Trading began around 9:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Twitter's share price rocketed well past the $26 per share minimum the company set, meaning they probably could have set the price a little higher if they wanted to. It closed at $44.90. So. Yeah. Which gives it a $24 billion valuation.
This is a big deal. I've mentioned before on the show that the Facebook IPO, despite its technical glitches, was actually done right in some ways.
I'll just reiterate that if you're going to take a company that you've been working on for several years and you're going to put it on the stock market, the idea is not for individual investors and the bankers to make money by pricing your stock so low that when it does its thing, everybody else makes money who's never been a part of it. The idea is to price it where you think the value is so that over time you can grow that value. Over time, you know, out the gate, it doesn't shoot up and, you know, you suddenly realize you've lost. Twitter was focused on that. That's why the rollout, I mean, they mentioned the rollout of this IPO weeks ago, and they mentioned, you know, everything they were trying to do. One of the things they were trying to do is to price it correctly, to not say that the valuation should be crazy high, $100 billion what Facebook thought they were worth. But to say that, hey, we've worked really hard. We want to place it in a place where it doesn't skyrocket and it doesn't drop. We want it to be incredibly stable from the moment it gets out there.
Yeah.
And that's what they attempted to do. But the fact is, people were all on Twitter about Twitter, and, you know, everybody made money. And that's a good thing. It's just that they weren't going for the sort of like, I'm going to put my stock out there at a buck and have it shoot up, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's doing better, in fact, than Netflix and LinkedIn is. So I think it's on its way to being a good, hot, steady stock to invest in.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think we're at all qualified to give people investment advice.
No,
but
certainly not.
Yeah, we're certainly not qualified to give anyone investment advice. But you look at those other stocks, and you know, they've landed in a place and they're moving back and forth. You also look at Twitter, and I think Twitter's big challenge in the next several weeks is going to show how they're using the money to grow a revenue model that is more robust than a promoted tweet. That's more robust than buying a trend for $200,000, or whatever the price is of those promoted trends. They have to figure out a way to enlighten people about the wares and services of their advertisers. And they have to do it in a way that makes people not feel threatened or interrupted or bamboozled or whatever. And that's a challenge for a service that's, you know, its biggest strength is that it's changed the fabric of society in several in several places around the world. It's clearly influential.
Yep.
Monetization is a tricky beast. It's not tricky on Facebook. On Facebook, you can throw ads or you can sell data. With Twitter, it's just it's a trickier beast because the whole thing is more subtle. I remember in 2006 or 7, maybe it was in 2009, Jon Stewart had a whole, you know, 5-minute bit on Twitter and what it is because he didn't get it. Well, he assumed that the average person wouldn't get it. And to date, I think that there are a lot of people, even in technology, who don't really understand Twitter. Even though it's incredibly disruptive technology, more disruptive than most technologies we've seen in the past, in recent years. So,
they're expected to earn $500 million this year, which is not bad, considering that there's no sort of conventional business model for Twitter.
So right.
Mainly sponsored tweets and other revenue streams. All right, let's take a break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to talk about this week is called, appropriately enough, Hatching Twitter, A True Story of Money, Power, Friendship, and Betrayal by Nick Bilton. Nick Bilton, as many listeners here might recognize that name, is the writer of the Bits blog, the technology blog, for the New York Times. Nick Bilton takes readers behind the scenes with a narrative that shows what happened inside Twitter as it grew at exponential speeds. It's a tale of betrayed friendships and high-stakes power struggles as the four founders, Biz Stone, Ev Williams, Jack Dorsey, and Noah Glass, went from everyday engineers to wealthy celebrities featured on magazine covers, Oprah, The Daily Show, and Time's list of the world's most influential people. So, you know, if you're thinking about investing in Twitter or if you're just fascinated by Twitter and you want to find out how Twitter came to be, the origin story of Twitter. This is a great little entree into that story. Hatching Twitter by Nick Bilton. So to download that free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to check out the rest of Audible's services. Even if you don't like their service, you can cancel it and you get to keep the book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, what could be better than one Marvel series on TV? How about five? Take a listen to this and come on back. Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuaken. This week, Disney and Netflix announced an unprecedented deal for Marvel TV to bring multiple original series of live-action adventures of four of Marvel's most popular characters exclusively to the world's leading internet TV network, beginning in 2015. The pioneering agreement calls for Marvel to develop four serialized programs leading to a mini-series program event. Led by a series focusing on Daredevil, followed by Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and Luke Cage, the epic will unfold over multiple years, taking Netflix members deep into the gritty world of heroes and villains of Hell's Kitchen, New York. Netflix is committed to a minimum of four 13-episode series, and culminating in Marvel's The Defenders, which is a mini-series event that reimagines a dream team of self-sacrificing heroic characters. Now, a little disclosure before we talk about this: I am a Disney employee, so this is a Disney deal, but I'm fairly free to talk about this. So basically, they're creating like a B tier of Avengers.
It's a Marvel Universe like project.
Yes.
And to jump in and just say, when we say Marvel Universe, several years ago, Marvel, in the face of one of their executives, basically decided they wanted to immerse users in the amount of story they have. So they actually got their B team, the Avengers, their A team being the X-Men,
yeah,
which was controlled by Fox. They got their B team being the Avengers, and in the person of, you know, Robert Downey Jr., they introduced Iron Man, and they didn't create a trilogy like what happened with Batman, as much as they created an immersive experience with the universe. They took all the characters surrounding the Avengers, and they built out interweaving storylines, and it culminated originally in the use of the Avengers. Lessons from the original Batman series showed everyone that you can't simply have a whole bunch of superheroes and villains in a movie with no context. The Avengers endeavored to create that context in a way that was... Marvel endeavored to create that context in a way that was really palatable. A couple movies about the Hulk, a couple movies about this character, that character. And then you go and you get the mad crossover genius himself, Joss Whedon, to put it together in a film like the Avengers. The Avengers ended up beating the Dark Knight Rises by about $200 million in movie theaters this summer, despite every analyst's claims that it was going to, you know, be a failure, because they provided that context. What they're doing here is attempting to do that on the small screen with the C team. When it says these are Marvel's most popular, some of Marvel's most popular characters, it's
that's
a bit of a
debatable.
This is Yeah, Daredevil is definitely a character that was a bigger. He was a bigger deal in the 90s and the 80s. Yeah. But he had a movie that was notorious for being a terrible comic book movie.
Sure.
And one of the reasons why was because there was absolutely no context there. Frankly, Hell's Kitchen doesn't exist in the way that Hell's Kitchen will exist in the paradigm for these stories. But they're going to be able to create an immersive universe that crisscrosses itself in many points, and that's what's gonna draw people in. So if you've ever been the type of person to like that Lord of the Rings extended edition and watch every single feature right around it, that's what you're getting. Like the webisodes, the episodes, stuff that's going to tie in with all the other stuff, and that's going to make it a more palatable thing. You're all in. It's an ecosystem of entertainment, so to speak. And the fact that it's happening on a network like Netflix, and that's what I'm going to call them, a network, it's going to allow them to be pretty innovative and to distribute in powerful ways. In many ways, it's going to be a sink or swim policy, I'm sure, where they're going to say, these characters are working, these characters aren't. Let's see what we can do. So this is a great thing. I think on some level, although Disney has its own online media distribution, this is definitely testing the waters to see what Netflix can do for them. And frankly, if Netflix were absorbed into the Disney mega, super amazing content making machine, I don't think any of us would be too surprised, and I don't think we'd be sad at all, because even though Netflix independence means that it can trade deals with many people, Disney's got buying power, and the idea of getting, you know, classic Disney titles streaming on Netflix would be great.
Again.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny that to think, like, 2 years ago, would we have ever seen something like this coming? Or even expected Disney to make a deal of this nature with Netflix, of all people?
Netflix is on the downturn. In fact, that when I say again, I'm referring to the fact that Disney, there were streaming classic Disney movies on Netflix, and then Disney quit their deal. They ended their contract with Netflix to stream their classic films.
When I said Disney titles, I didn't necessarily mean like the animated classics. I don't think those are appropriate for Netflix. There's too much money in keeping those in the quote-unquote vault until they release them. I just mean like everything out of ABC. Scandals on Netflix.
Mighty Ducks.
Say again?
Mighty Ducks.
Once Upon a Time on Netflix. But right now, you know, Amazon's the only place to stream DuckTales. Netflix, if they can gain access to something like DuckTales or any of that Disney Afternoon from when, you know, I was a teenager, that would be a coup. That would be something that would keep me on Netflix indefinitely. Like, what do I want to watch? I'm going to revisit these stories that I never really paid attention to because I was a little kid. And wow, they're really cohesive and well thought out and well whatever. You know, there's just stuff there. So,
I think this is a great deal for Netflix. It really sort of reinforces their place as a top competitor for digital distribution, along with HBO and Showtime and the like. But I have to ask, there's a couple of questions when I see something like this that I have to ask. And one of them is, why is it that Disney didn't keep this deal for their own distribution channel, for ABC? And the other question is, like a broader question is, do you feel that Marvel may be oversaturating the market with their properties?
Content? Yeah. Well, Marvel's content is incredibly diverse. So they have so many characters and so many stories that unless you see the Marvel stamp on it, you don't necessarily know it's connected. So there's something there. People like immersion, and Netflix is about immersion. This is point two. Netflix is about saying, hey, watch 13 episodes at a clip. Get deep into this. Don't worry that the episode this week isn't a good episode, so you won't come back. Just watch them all, or watch a bunch of them at once, and we guarantee you, once you hit episode 4, you're going to be like, oh yeah, I'm into this, because you've already invested the time. So Netflix is a great place for that. ABC is expensive. Netflix is less expensive. ABC has an affiliate network. The shows have to get out to them. Ratings matter more. You don't have the long runway in order to have your show take off on network television the same way you do with online television. So It piggybacks on, it's a sub-bullet to the whole immersion thing. You know, yeah. if people don't dig it when it first comes out, they're not going to be able to change it. So Netflix is doing this. And then finally, Disney's saying, let me take these C-level characters and see what Netflix can do with them. Netflix is going to reach out to talent in order to produce these things. And Disney, you know, Disney's going to work with them, I'm sure. But it's unclear, you know, exactly who's doing the heavy lifting in terms of production, casting, writing, all that stuff. But Netflix has proven that it's capable. And, well, I don't think this stuff is going to be on the level of, you know, Emmy award-winning House of Cards stuff, just because that's not the nature of comic book-based stuff. I do think there's a chance that it could
will it be at least on the level of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
That's what I'm saying. I think it could be on the level of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which has come across as a little campy,
yeah,
but definitely some fun. Netflix can probably add a layer of seriousness to it. A layer of darkness that I think is very important to what older comic book fans want. They want a certain level of darkness.
And, you know, frankly, they could get a little grittier, a little, yeah, absolutely. They could use profanity in ways that they can't on ABC.
They can kill people,
yeah,
with blood.
Yep.
Right? They can do that kind of thing. So Disney, as a super family-friendly location, can take some risks with Netflix on this, because Netflix is going to have to make these characters a bit more, for lack of a better term, dramatic than they were represented. And if you read some of the older comic books, I mean, they're really quite silly if you read them as they were written,
sure,
back in the 60s and 70s. Like, especially if you read, like, you think Thor is kind of a weird title. When you first read Thor, the original Thor, there's a professor who's got a stick that he found in a cave, and he bangs it across on the floor, and he gets the power of Thor. The whole Asgard reimagining happened way later, and there's not a lot of, you don't need to do the super expository thought bubbles and all that other stuff like that. So there's, as they reimagine and take their titles and take them to the next level, it's like how Battlestar Galactica was reimagined and taken,
right,
to the next level.
Right.
They need distribution channels that have a bit more diversity than you know, just using their particular talent. And I think that's, they're outsourcing, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. All right, moving on here. Snapchat, the rapidly growing messaging service, recently spurned an all-cash acquisition offer from Facebook for close to $3 billion, according to people briefed on the matter and reported in the Wall Street Journal. Evan Spiegel, Snapchat's 23-year-old co-founder and CEO, will not likely consider an acquisition or investment at least until early next year. They said Spiegel is hoping Snapchat's numbers of users and messages will grow enough by then to justify an even larger valuation. Snapchat, as we've talked about on the show before, specializes in ephemeral mobile messages, including text and photographs that disappear after a few seconds. Service has not generated any revenue, but is especially popular amongst teens and in young adults who use the app to send messages to friends. Facebook had earlier offered to buy Snapchat for more than $1 billion. In recent weeks, Facebook contacted Snapchat again to discuss an all-cash offer that would have valued Snapchat at $3 billion or more. Facebook's interested in Snapchat because more of its users are tapping the service via smartphones. And Facebook said last month that fewer young teens were using Facebook on a daily basis. So I think they're looking to reach out into other venues that people are using. But interesting that Snapchat is holding out for a larger number. I wonder if they'll get it, in light of Twitter's IPO and Facebook.
I just Snapchatted crazy right now. I'm just Snapchatted a photo of myself podcasting, and I'll send it on. I don't see any means that Snapchat is going to decrease in activity. I just don't know. You know, I don't know where the profitability comes in, and maybe it's with messaging, with selling, you know, putting ads in places that people can.
Not even. You don't have to put ads anywhere. I think that they can take a, because, I mean, that would just annoy the shit out of you, right? You did some Snapchat, you saw an ad. I feel like they could just take all the words being used,
figure out what people are talking about, and along with demographic data, and provide that to advertisers. So you wouldn't advertise on Snapchat, but you would know that the young people are trending on this level or that level or whatever, and that would inform your buys on other platforms. I mean, Snapchat's kind of that. When someone offers you $3 billion, it's really difficult to say no, yeah. Right?
I mean, no Waze, kidding.
Waze is a platform that I think we would all agree that, you know, has an incredible actual value to the users. Snapchat does too, no doubt. But Waze has a really tangible value to users. And Waze got snapped up and moved, you know, possibly is going to have to move from Israel to Silicon Valley in some or all part for just $1 billion. Tumblr, which has an incredible amount of users, and it doesn't exactly have a revenue plan, also $1 billion. The fact that the guy running Snapchat is 23 years old, I do have to ask if his judgment. I have to ask about his judgment when someone says, "Hey, look, $3 billion in cash, not cash in stock, not equity later, not some sort of like maturing stake or whatever. I'm going to give you $3 billion in raw cash."
Yeah.
And you're going to say no. At 23 years old, you can A, become part of the acquihire and run that part of the service throughout the whole thing, or B, you can simply do something else.
I have seen deals like this, potential deals like this backfire, where a entrepreneur held out for too long, and
only to be disrupted by another technology that eats your lunch.
Yep.
Snapchat is cool, but I mean, I don't know. You know, it's got a good gimmick with the whole thing to disappear and all that stuff. But you know, frankly, it's not something that Kik can't implement. There are other things out there. It's not that unique. It just has so many users.
Right.
And yes, the activity is going to grow. But at $3 billion, you can buy anything you want, start anything you want, take the money and run.
Now, granted, he was getting some offers from it appeared that he was getting some other offers as well that were coming in. Now, I don't know if they were stocks, but they did seem. I thought I read somewhere that one was close to $4 billion. So
there was a Chinese company, that was offering him.
And another thing too is like, what's going to happen to the legacy? So you could be offered all this money, but I mean, is Facebook? Facebook just released a new version of their iPhone app that has Messenger built in. You tap the button and it cards you over to the Messenger app because they really want that online community to be hanging out there. Is this the kind of thing that Facebook would shutter? They'd spend the money and shutter it after trying to funnel their users in. We don't know. What we do know is that when they got Instagram, Instagram remained largely unchanged with the exception of the video. We know that Instagram ads are coming, but for the most part, Instagram is largely unchanged. The management is still intact, it seems. So they've been reasonable stewards with that kind of thing. I can see why perhaps, you know, because Facebook is used to do a lot of messaging. I can actually see why Google might be possibly more interested than Facebook in Snapchat for getting this mobile usage up. But regardless, part of the thing about Snapchat is that it's not tied to your online presence in the same way that Facebook and Google are. And from a user perspective, if people are getting angry about having their YouTube comments tied to Google Plus, imagine your Snapchat stuff being tied to Facebook.
Yeah, really. All right, moving on here. This is one of my favorite stories of this week, to be honest. A Saskatchewan man has developed an affordable 3D printer that has attracted worldwide attention and more than $700,000 in crowdsourced funding. Rylan Grayston from Yorkton said that curiosity fueled his quest to create a 3D copier that sells for just $100. Other high-tech 3D printers sell for several thousand or more. Now, if you guys know anything about 3D printing, and I'm sure you guys have fairly rudimentary knowledge of 3D printing, there's like several ways to do it. The most popular and common way to 3D print out there is by extruding hot material layer by layer onto a substrate until you build up a three-dimensional shape. And but the way this guy did it was incredibly fascinating. Like he completely rebooted the process and created something that was gave him the ability to create this printer for about $100. The way it works is it converts an object, a 3D object, into file data using a sound card on his laptop. The information on the audio file is then sent to electromagnetic mirrors and laser beams that vibrate and move in relationship to the data, and the lasers hit a tub of resin, of specialized acrylic resin, that is the tub is raised layer by layer feeding water into it from the bottom. And so the tub of resin raises layer by layer, and as the laser hits it layer by layer, it builds the object up from in the tub of liquid, which is amazing. I'm going to have to link a video to the process actually being done. It's called the Peachy Printer. And he started a Kickstarter project to fund the mass production of this. And more than 720,000 people pitched in, and this project is completely funded. So really a sort of a groundbreaking step. If anyone can get 3D printing down to the sub $100 mark, that's really sort of the watershed, I think, event that will kick 3D printing into being in everybody's home, being like as common as the
actual printer,
as the actual like paper printer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also going to be incredibly disruptive, that it gets, you can get access to, you know, everything from Lego parts to gun stuff, via this simple to use 3D right. process. So, I mean, it's fantastic that this is being crowdfunded and being able to put forth. But I'm also left wondering, this guy gets 700K, Snapchat's getting is being offered 3 billion. How on earth in this world did Everpix die?
we brushed upon that briefly. We didn't talk about that last week because we were going to talk about that with you and you weren't on the show. Yeah, that was kind of a shame to hear about that, since they had such a potentially awesome product.
No, had an awesome product. Right. They just didn't get the funding for it. It's astounding to think that that the best photo sharing service that every single tech insider thinks the world has ever seen is now defunct. And right. I mean, these products are good. Snapchat is good. 3D printing with lasers and sound cards is futuristic and awesome and Elon Musk like. But it's amazing that these things get chased down. And even though the photo problem isn't solved, the guys who solved it are, looking for jobs.
Yeah, that's a real shame. I don't know. How you're right. I don't know how something that, I just started to use it upon your recommendation on our 300th episode there. And then like a week into using it, I get this notice that it's closed down, or they're closing it down for good. And I'm like, what? How could this be possible? So, yeah, it's a shame, but maybe its death will make way for another service that does basically the same thing, but improves upon it.
I mean, the cool thing about all this is that this guy's from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's like it's like Saskatchewan. Literally, like when people you watch all those old TV shows, this is gonna put Saskatchewan on the map.
Yeah,
like this is gonna put Saskatchewan.
This will put Saskatchewan on the map. Yeah. Anyway, I I missed the Kickstarter funding of this, which I could kick myself for. I missed it by like just a couple of days. So I put myself on the email list and I'm hoping to hear from him when he gets his store up. I think he also has plans online for free that you can download and build one of these yourself based on the plans. So I may not wait for his store and just go ahead and try and attempt it myself with the plans. And finally, our last headline for the evening. Russian security expert Eugene Kaspersky revealed that Russian astronauts carried a removable drive into space, which infected systems on the space station. He didn't elaborate on the impact of the infection on operations of the space station, but he said that it appears that that prior to May of this year, when the U.S. United Space Alliance, the group that oversees operation of the ISS, moved all systems entirely to Linux to make them more, quote, stable and reliable. Dozens of laptops used on board the station had been using Windows XP, which is inherently more vulnerable to infection from malware than Linux. And according to Kaspersky, the infections occurred on laptops used by scientists who use Windows as their main platform and carried USB sticks into space when visiting the ISS. He says that shows that not being connected to the internet does not prevent you from being infected. And in another example, in an unnamed Russian nuclear facility, facility was also cut off from public internet when it was infected by the Stuxnet malware. So even astronauts, even under government auspices, even in space, thousands of miles outside of our atmosphere, even there isn't safe from the potential infection of computer viruses.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really not surprised that
you're going to blame the Russians.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's like American parts, Russian parts, all made in Taiwan.
Yeah.
That's for anyone who's ever seen Armageddon. If you haven't, then you need to go and do that.
And probably not see it. You can pass on Armageddon.
I'm sorry. Did you just say pass on Armageddon?
It's been a long time since I've seen it, granted, but
it's all about the cultural references of Armageddon. It's not about the fact that it's some Oscar-winning film, man. And that is like a quintessential piece of that. In fact, when watching Gravity and noting that the Russian capsule and the Chinese capsule are not too different from one another, that Americans learn how to use them, you understand that Russian equipment, American equipment, all made in Taiwan. It makes sense. It's a whole thing.
Yep. All right, we're going to take a one last break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Yeah. Word. Adjective. Pronoun. Adverb. Run on and on, where my gerunds at? Parenthetical. Shit, motherfucker, ass tits, cunt, cock, motherfucker, shit, ass tits, motherfucker, shit, come on. Fickety fuck, fickety fuck, fickety fuck, fickety fuck, 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 fuck. Shit, motherfucker, ass tits, cunt, cock, motherfucker, shit, ass tits, motherfucker, shit, come on. Fickety fuck, fickety fuck, fickety fuck, fickety fuck, 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 fuck. You take some shit, put it up on the wall, check it out for a while. You take that shit up off of the wall, put it down on the floor in a glass bowl. You take some fuck, put it up on the wall where the shit used to be. You take that fuck up off of the wall, put it down on the floor with the shit in a glass bowl.
What? Yo, here's another little piece of advice. Bars. You take some fuck, then some shit, then some fuck, then some shit. You got a fuck shit stack. A fuck shit stack. Take some fuck, then some shit.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adafwakin. So let's wrap up our show here with our Drill Down video of the week. And I was stuck for finding a video of the week for this week. And Dwayne, I'm sorry, no, Tosin, you linked me to this Key and Peele video. And Key and Peele, obviously, they've kind of disrupted comedy with their take on sketch comedy. As featured on Comedy Central. And speaking of disruptors, Freddie Wong, who is incredibly popular on YouTube, has just disrupted the way special effects are produced on a homebrew scale. And for this video, Freddie Wong has teamed up with Key and Peele for this sketch called Mexican Standoff. Which sort of takes the tropes of the iconic Mexican standoff between three cops and like turns every expectation on its ear and pushes it to the limit, and it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, it's really brilliant just how they're able to take this typical trope and not only engage with all the familiar aspects that you've seen, but take it a step further.
Yeah.
And just make it. And I just love these sort of short comedy bits short comedy as well as innovative, you know, graphically intense things that people have been able to do now and post online. I mean, that's kind of a pretty marvelous thing of our era. And I know we recently had, you know, episode 300 and 301, and just that kind of speaks to the creativity that this day and age can spur, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this happen in the early 2000s when it came to music. A lot of this indie music was spawned from the fact that you could take a laptop and some good equipment and, consumer grade, but good equipment, prosumer, maybe we'll call it, and you could really create, you know, compelling music, and that only expanded when the iPad showed up in 2010. The same has happened to radio shows. What we're doing today is based on the fact that the internet, along with certain bits of hardware, allow us to put together good content. Movies have always been the final frontier when it comes to that. You can make an independent movie great. We've seen them all over Kickstarter. You can make a drama. You can make all sorts of stuff. But getting those special effects, that's always been the province of Hollywood. It's always been the province of, you know, the industrial lights and magic. and Weta Workshop and all those guys. Those people who have astounding funds and the ability to grab talent and to remake everything. But now the computers are getting so powerful. And, you know, we have more people using them and the imaginations are flying off all over the place. We are in an age, Tosin's totally right, that you can get a little bit more out. You can get some stuff that frankly looks better than half of the B movies you see on Netflix, right? The kind of like Transmorphers
stuff you see. And you can make your own popularity too, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Freddie Wong has proven that. He's essentially proven that you can democratize visual effects.
What a Freddie Wong gets on Kickstarter and makes a big budget movie with not a big budget, a big budget quality movie with not a big budget, that will be that watershed moment that says we're in the golden age of UGC, user generated content.
Yeah.
That's going to be that moment. Because 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Elephant's Dream was a CGI animated movie that got all sorts of awards and accolades, and it was made from completely open source free tools. And it was distributed, you know, via BitTorrent legally by those who created it, because they said, we want to show that you can get stuff done without needing a DreamWorks or Pixar or whatever. You don't need those machines to pull it up. Now imagine this new upcoming Mac Pro in the hands of people with those tools and that talent. And you really begin to wonder whether these big studios need to be worried about people disrupting. Now, the distribution has to happen online. The big screen is going to be difficult for some time.
Yeah.
But Netflix has shown that the small screen is a way to get in a lot of people's houses, faces, especially given the fact that the economy, while growing, is, you know, definitely a hard thing. It's a hard thing right now for people to spend 20 something bucks in a movie theater. We saw Blockbuster close down last week.
Right.
In the next 20 or 30 years, maybe even less, we could see the movie theater shut down too. I mean, Fathom events are not going to keep movie theaters going.
Right.
So I really feel like this is, you know, Key and Peele are obviously on the, you know, as social commentators, as much as they are comedians and sketch comedians, this is just showing Freddie Wong, along with them, I guess, beginning to show us what's possible. And again, you get those guys on a Kickstarter with great tools and great talent. And just like we're seeing some of these amazing, epic video games begin to gain traction on Kickstarter, I think we can see static content like movies do the same.
And it's just plain funny. It's just a plain funny skit. So take a look at that. Enjoy it. We'll have the link in the embedded in the show notes as well. And that about wraps it up for our show tonight. So let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. You can also check out gplus.to/DwayneD. Google thinks my name is Dwayne. They don't like it. They're working on that. And those are the two chief places.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at Mr. Baby Man. Just do a Google search for Mr. Baby Man, and you'll find all my social network links up there. Also on Twitter and Facebook at Mr. Baby Man. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on that site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.